onto the moon. I guess they need some kind of a global communication system. I doubt that whatever they planted there is going to be effective for vast distances. So I think it's more of a PR thing than a practical exercise in getting ready for the future.
Yeah, I agree with you, Anthony and Gene. The problem was that the vehicle launches on the side and the battery is depleted, and communication doesn't work as it is, but the company says that it was a success because they were able to deliver it. So next time you want to make a phone call from the moon to the Earth, you have to just wait a little bit longer. So the next one is in glass, the answer to increasing data center efficiency. It is about the glass wafers. So we have the silicon wafers, and now glass wafers are trying to take over, and there are different opinions from different manufacturers. Of course, glass you have to make, and silicon you actually have to cut. So that's the story. I'm not going to stay on it. Just go to the next one because we have a limited time. Cave discovery reveals previous unknown prehistoric human. And there was fossilized bone fragments unearthed in caves in northern Spain in 2022. And it was previously unknown human population. So we're not talking about Lucy, that is 3.5 million years old, but we're talking about something that is humanoid, but actually is being called humanin. And for the humanin, I found that humanin is actually genus of a gorilla and also of early Homo sapiens, which is grouped separately within the subfamily of Hominii. So, according to that, hold on, let me drop. Okay, because I don't want to overtime. That was the first hominin that was found in Europe. It is much younger than Lucy was. It's 1.1 million years, and it was found in Cima de Elefante in Atapucura Mountains in Europe, and that is Spain. So the team did find something that is linking a human to gorillas. Interesting finding. And it was quite a common species at that time, and they say that it's 650,000 years old. Again, I mean 650,000 years ago, that was a time when that early human being was very much present on the planet Earth. And of course it died up. I wonder if Dr. Ware has any comment on it.
WS2N.
Yeah, Paul?
Yeah, is Wesley on frequency, or has he got a different mic or something? Tough copy.
I think he's on Echo Link.
Oh, okay, understood. I'll try to listen.
Yeah, I had a question about cell phones when I was talking about the cell phones on the moon, but we have a little time left. So eventually at the beginning of your session you can answer to it. And we had the unfortunate landing of intuitive machines lander, which is IM-2 lander, that actually cut short cell phones on the moon. And then I asked to Roy, who needs the cell phones on the moon, and I said that this is not such a silly question as it looks like. so maybe after when you start your time, you can comment on it. N2XGN.
No problem. Yeah, that was Intuitive Machines. That's the one that fell over. Okay. Yeah, they only had a short time to test that. Yeah, that's right. That was by Nokia. Yeah, better luck next time. They got another one going up either at the end of the year or the beginning of next year. We'll try again.
That was a joint program. That was Nokia and Intuitive Machines, both of them, and the NASA. They did it. So batteries depleted, but Nokia surges was a success. So I was just trying to understand what they are talking about. But anyhow, thank you for that. Okay, the next one, because I'm trying to finish before the time. The use of pipe as high energy, low frequency waveguide between two distant points. So imagine that you have a regular pipe, the pipe that you can buy at Home Depot. And the pipe is actually the waveguide. The thing is that the material of that pipe is not necessarily the best for the waveguide. So I was thinking that the natural gas transmission system in Ukraine consists of 23,950 miles of pipelines and about 1,000 mile long pipeline was exporting gas from Russia to Europe via Ukraine, and it became interesting when in January 1st, 2025, Ukraine terminated the transit of Russian gas to Europe, ending 34 years almost uninterrupted supply since the collapse of Soviet Union. So it was, I was looking into the ability to use that retired disconnected by Ukraine former Soviet gas pipeline as high energy waveguide, replacing the use of high voltage wires, transformers between the large parts of the country. So yet of course they could put those wires inside of the pipe, but the pipe by itself is about 4.5 feet, 1.4 meter, and that pipe 2 years ago was used by Russian soldiers to walk inside of it 11 miles with intent to launch surprise attack on Ukrainians. Unfortunately, some gas was still there, and Ukrainians found what they did. So, oh boy, Russian inventiveness is shocking. Anyhow, but anyway, let me drop so I don't over time. Okay. So I have some conclusion of it. The cutoff frequency for the 4.5 foot pipe is 1.1 megahertz, which is perfect. The lower the better, the smaller the losses, and the circular waveguide supports the transverse electric and transverse magnetic mode. In a circular waveguide, T11 mode is dominant, and in this mode, the electromagnetic wave propagates via circular waveguide with minimum loss and maximum minimum degradation. So circular waveguides will not only carry the or propagate signals with high power, but they do that if, so we're talking about T11 mode, if we are above the cutoff frequency. So cutoff frequency for it is 1.1 megahertz. If we're talking about the waveguide, because this is a waveguide, we could talk also coaxial cable. Why don't we use the coaxial cables for electrical power in form of the electromagnetic wave? Let me drop for a moment. Okay. The sequential cables are practically good to 3 gigahertz, and above that, the losses are too excessive. So we're talking 2 dBs per 100 meters at 100 megahertz in coaxial cable. Then that loss at 1 gigahertz is no longer 2 dBs, it's 10 dBs, and at 10 gigahertz is already 50 dBs. So power rating typically the order of 1 kilowatt at 100 megahertz will be, after the losses, 200 watts at 2 gigahertz. So actually that's why we don't use it to send the power. Rather than using electromagnetic wave, we decided that you want to use a copper wire for it. So, but there is something like a short piece of coaxial cable that works to 40 gigahertz, but it's extremely expensive. We also have a twin wire line, so we use it for antennas, and that was used for connecting TV sets, antennas with the TV sets in old time, and another one is microstrip lines. It was widely used in microwave integrated circuits, so when we're talking about the surface wave rejected by Dr. Ray, the Zenek wave is also known as surface plasma polariton that has primary application microstrips. Then another one is rectangular waveguide. It's like the pipe, but it's rectangular and works in frequencies usually greater than 3 gigahertz. But let's say, for example, 5 gigahertz, we have 1 megawatt power, then we have the losses 4 dBs per 300 feet. And then we're talking about optical fibers for our internet. This is around the world. It's on the sea, is everywhere, and the loss is only 0.2 dBs per mile, actually per kilometer, so it's a little bit shorter than a mile. But if we look at the optical fibers, we may say, well, optical fiber is actually circular waveguide, it's only smaller. So conclusion is yes, we can convert pipe line into a circular waveguide, and it is doable, although likely the straight or slightly bent miles-long gas pipeline. So I was thinking, how about we send electromagnetic waves in active gas pipeline and we use it as a waveguide? I don't know what would happen, but it's an interesting story. Back to you. Okay, I'm sorry. I overtimed the repeater. And another question. If let's say we have that piece of pipe which is in diameter 4.5 feet, and we put one guy from one side of the pipe and another guy from the second side of the pipe, and we have two walkie-talkies or two radios, what would be the line of sight like? What do you think, Dr. Ray?
I don't know offhand. It depends on what the resonance of the cavity is. If the cavity is resonant for that frequency, it'll act as a line of sight if it's intact. If it's not that frequency, then it's not going to be a terribly effective transmission conduit.
I was thinking about the coupling between the waveguide. It doesn't matter if the waveguide is the rectangular or it's rounded like a pipe. It has to have a certain impedance match, and if that is not met, then the pipe cannot be used as a waveguide. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to match the impedances, because we kind of talked about in the past that mismatch in impedance causes reflection and diminishes the ability to transfer energy. But you also need a waveguide that's resonant at that frequency, otherwise it's not going to set up a proper waveguide mode.
Okay. And also when I was talking about TM and TE mode transfers, electric and transfer magnetic mode, then I mentioned about TE11 mode. So the TE11 mode refers to dominant mode of propagation in circular waveguides. So it's characteristic to circular waveguides. It is characterized by electric field and magnetic field being perpendicular to the direction of propagation, and it offers minimal attenuation to the signal. So if we were to use a gas pipeline or a retired gas pipeline as a waveguide, that would be the mode that we would like to use. But my question to you is, what do you think about active gas handling pipeline used as a waveguide? Back to you.
Well, I mean, you're sort of asking for problems. If the gas line is perfectly intact, gas doesn't ignite just because you put an electrical charge through it. You need an oxidizing agent. If you don't have an oxidizing agent, a reducing agent is going to sit there and look at you. So it's not just a spark. It's you have to make sure that it's perfectly sealed and no oxygen gets into the tank. Otherwise, if you have a mixture of oxygen and a reducing agent and you put a spark through it, that's not a good idea.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was thinking about the bends. In the bends, we have so many of weird phenomena, and that might be very much unsafe. So the last one that I have, because the time is really ending, molecule DDL-920, I think you would be able to say a few words about it. And what is important in it is that they tried to use it for Alzheimer's, but then the scientists, a few days ago, they found that, the prime found it earlier, but they only start to talk about it. DDL-920 is a novel drug researched by UCLA, and is promised for returning brain functions to those who have a stroke, and it was tested on animals, and it was almost 100% return of the brain function after the stroke. So for those people who have a heart attack or they have a problem with the heart, it is very much promising. But I'm not a doctor, that's why I'm asking Dr. Roy and to XGN.
I'm a little confused. Why should it have any benefit for people with heart attacks? It operates in the brain. It kind of rebuilds neural connections. That's why it's of interest for people who've had strokes. I don't believe it has any particularly a good, bad, or a different effect for people who've had heart attacks. Where did you find that one?
In the scientific paper that is from the college, that's the U.S. college database, and the quote is, the discovery is particularly exciting as it marks the first time intervention has been identified that can potentially restore brain function post-stroke by targeting specific neural pathways. Back to you.
Yeah, but what does that have to do with heart attacks? These are two different organs. They're talking about the brain. They're not talking about the heart.
Oh, yeah. After you have a heart attack, it. There is often the situation the brain doesn't have enough of oxygen. And the brain function could create brain damage. So that actually is like a form of returning. It was tested on animals, returning the brain functions, and it shows almost 100% return of the brain functions. But
the problem is that's really extrapolating beyond belief, because what probably they're alluding to is the way that they induced the stroke in the rats, because it was a rat experiment, was they probably stopped their heart pumping. That's a kind of non-traumatic heart stopping, because it was induced artificially. People who've had heart attacks where their heart stopped pumping so that their brain was had secondary damage, you still got to deal with a damaged heart that suffered just stopping pumping. So it's not quite that simple. You don't just magically start the heart again. It has no reset button, and then you go and you fix the stroke that was produced from the heart attack. It's a lot more complicated under circumstances where natural disease causes the secondary brain damage.
Okay. So thank you for explaining this one. Now, could you explain Alzheimer's disease model on mice? So I sent you the link. I know if you had a time to go through that. It says that the same method was used for Alzheimer's disease curing. But
yeah, but then you have a problem of how do they induce the Alzheimer's? Do they have a transgenic mice that are bred to have early onset Alzheimer's? Is it the same as human Alzheimer's? There's a lot of confusion in the human model of Alzheimer's to begin with. There was something about in some of the stuff that you sent me about how we can slow down present drugs can slow down Alzheimer's. That's very problematic. That's very questionable. We've been talking about Alzheimer's being caused by plaque buildup of amyloid protein, and that's not a sure thing either anymore. So we're kind of in a big question mark of, you know, what causes Alzheimer's? Is Alzheimer's in humans the same as induced Alzheimer's in lab animals? And the drugs that are available do little harm, but they also don't do a great deal of benefit. So we're still at the very beginning of dealing with Alzheimer's. So, these experiments are useful. A few of them turn out to be of value. Most of them turn out to be of no value. That's just the nature of how research works.
Okay, so talking about the sources, it is official website for United States government is National Library of Medicine. It is PubMed. So you say it's questionable. Thank you very much for that. But how should I look at that publisher? Is that the source that I should rely on in my future findings? Back to you.
You just unfortunately have to keep up with current information. You can't base things, because there's a lot of very nice articles that say all kinds of things that have been discounted and proven wrong through the years. So just because it's published by a nice university with a lot of credentials, unfortunately, sometimes they get things wrong. And one of the things that have been really up in the air is the whole concept of Alzheimer's. The amyloid plaques were a very popular theory for maybe 20 years, maybe 30, and recent research has caused people to kind of rethink that. So you can't depend upon research articles from 30 years ago, even with great credentials, you have to kind of look at the latest, greatest research on the subject and the opinions of professionals doing the research today, not 30 years ago.
Okay, thank you very much for all of that. Thank you very much for giving me a chance to talk today, and I think it's a time for Paul. Dr. Roy, back to you.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Thank you again for your participation. This is AC2GS. I hope everyone kind of enjoyed this segment. I was hoping that we would be able to get to Ed's question, because it's an interesting one. Hopefully we will get to it next Sunday. So stay tuned. Now, though, it's time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
Thank you, Roy.
Roy, you know, I don't have all that much. If you wanted to take Ed, that's okay. You know, over to you, Roy.
Yeah, that's very kind of you. I think Ed said that he usually shuts down at 10 p.m. I'll give him a yell and see if he's still out there. Ed, GJE, are you still out there? Yeah, he left at 10 p.m., so we'll do it next week.
GSWS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, yeah, good topics tonight. And, by the way, that WD-40, I have a white lithium grease made by that company I use all the time. So, you know, one of the many different products. That's always very good for linkages and things like that. So, okay, there's a launch tomorrow. I'm going to be interested to see if this thing gets off the ground and into orbit. It's called the Spectrum. That's the name of the rocket. It's made by a company in Germany. German company. And the company's name is ISAR. And they're going to be launching from all places, Norway. They built a launch complex in Norway that's never been used before. So I'm going to be interested to see if this first of a kind rocket, is launching from a complex that's never been used before, will be able to make it to orbit. Europe is always trying to eventually have a launch complex in Europe that would be able to put spacecraft into orbit. They're not new at it. They've been doing it for decades. The European Space Agency has taken rockets from that they built and shipped them over to South America, to French Guiana, you know, the north shores of South America, right near the equator, and have launched from there for decades. They had the Ariane 1 rocket, 2, 3, 4, you know, all the way up the line. 4 was, you know, many, many flights with the Ariane 4. Eventually the Ariane 5, I think, they were getting close to 100 flights. That really heavy lift vehicle. So they would launch very heavy spacecraft to any kind of orbit they wanted to. Including the one of the final flights of the Ariane 5 was the James Webb Space Telescope. And you know what that is? It's, you know, 4 times the distance from the moon. So heavy lift vehicles, no problem. But your space agency, they also had the smaller vehicles. They had the Vega, which launched quite a few times. And they have had some problems with the newer version of it, so it's been delayed, but now it's getting back into a rotation. That's a medium lift vehicle, again, all from South America. But now they, you know, their goal is to be able to launch from, you know, the mainland of Europe. So this this rocket, it's called Spectrum. It's of all things, it's a fuel that they're using is a propane, liquid propane, and of course liquid oxygen. So it'll be the first time a propane fueled rocket would be make it to orbit if this thing succeeds. It's quite large. It's not a heavy lift vehicle, but it's not a small lift vehicle like the Electron rocket by Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab launches, they have three launch complexes, two in New Zealand and one in Virginia that they launch from, and that's the one that's it's a pretty much all type of rocket. It's only about 60 feet tall, around 4 feet in diameter, but it's able to launch, you know, 600-700 pounds to orbit. Maybe even launch small satellites that are presently in orbit around the moon. So that's the Electron rocket, and that's made by Rocket Lab. This other company, ISAR, I-S-A-R, named after a river in Germany, they are putting this rocket out. That's going to be, well, they say 97 feet, so let's call it 100 feet tall. So it's a lot taller than the 60-foot rocket that the Electron has. It's also a 6-foot diameter, a little over 6 feet instead of the 4-foot diameter. So it's a good-sized rocket. Will be able to launch over 3 times the amount of weight or payload to orbit. When they're done, they should be able to put a ton and a half into orbit, where an Electron rocket can do 600-700 pounds. So looking forward to seeing if this thing makes it off the ground. And it was scheduled to go a couple of days ago. You know, they have weather issues in Norway. I mean, this thing is up by the Arctic Circle. So it will be going into a polar orbit. In fact, once they get rolling, if this particular rocket is successful, they plan on doing like 30 launches a year. And they would all be, from what I see, polar orbits, because they can't go west. If they go west, they're going to be over. I think that would definitely put them over land. Although they might be able to launch east, you know, similar to what Israel does. When Israel launches a rocket, which are very few, to orbit, they go east instead of west. Correction, the opposite. They go west instead of east. Anyway, we'll see how this company does. Tomorrow morning, the window starts at 7:30 our time. And the window lasts around 3 hours. And it would be very unusual if they make it. Very few companies with their first rocket have made it to orbit. Yeah, it took SpaceX. They made it to orbit on their fourth rocket. Fourth try. Some of the companies have had problems. Especially some of the newer ones. In fact, a couple of them looks like they're not going to be launching anymore. This thing, I'm not sure where the control center is. It's probably in Germany, where the European Space Agency has their control center. I'll be interested to see where that is, because what it's, I forgot the name of it. I'll think of it later. So any questions or comments, this is WS2N for the Space Network.
This is Brian.
Good evening, Brian. Over to you.
Hi, K
KF2ZZ, the station ID. I was reading about this company. It's called Mag something. They produce plasma engines that give off a maximum of 10 newtons of force for satellites. Have you heard about them? Mag something.
Producing plasma engines? No. Are these a different form of ion engines? I mean, there's plenty of those things around from a different company. Is it a form of the ion engine? You know, like the Hale thrusters or something like that.
I'm going to take a look on my phone for 1 second and get you the name. I thought you might find it interesting.
Okay. Yeah, it would be interesting to find out. I mean, I'll be surprised to find out that they've flown before because they pretty much follow all the new engines that are out there. You know, the large ones and the small ones. Well, you know, that's pretty good. You know, there's a lot of companies doing this now, and they're all trying to get on board. There's one of them that's creating a thrust that's just out of water. Shooting water out of it, just little tiny drops. You know, just for real fine. Fine movement on these small CubeSats. There's a lot of action going on. So over to you, Brian. Any luck?
I'm looking. Give me one moment.
Okay. Very good. And like this one that's going up tomorrow. Propane. I mean, this rocket is not designed to be reusable. But, you know, they would be able to do that further down the road because propane is an extremely clean gas. They're really a derivative of, you know, liquid natural gas. Just like butane and a couple of the other gases. But propane is very clean, very, the idea of if you go to reusability, you want to have an engine that's not going to have any soot in it or anything like that. Although there's no problem in doing it, you know, SpaceX has done it hundreds of times, and they're using basically kerosene, which is much dirtier than methane or propane. A lot of the new rocket companies are going to be done with methane, which is much cleaner than the RP-1, which is kerosene. But propane is even cleaner. So we'll see. And by the way, one other company that made it to orbit on their very first shot was Jeff Bezos' company, Blue Origin, when they launched New Glenn, and that was a very heavy lift rocket. You know, that's over 4 million pounds thrust, or around 4 million pounds thrust. Anyway, over to you, Brian. Any?
The company is called MagDrive, MagDrive, one word. They're based out of the UK, and they have a plasma thruster which produces a force of 10 newtons, which is equivalent to taking a chicken egg, basically, and dropping it from like a couple of feet. Or maybe even a foot or so.
That's what I'm saying. There's a couple of companies that are looking for low thrust items to put on very small satellites. These CubeSats are all
10 centimeters cube, you know, or roughly, you know, 4 inches on each side. That's a standard size, and then they come in different sizes. They call them 2U, 3U, 4U, 6U. Each number represents how many, basically, CubeSats are put together. You know, so you might have one go up the size of a toaster, and they might call that 3U or something. But they need a little, sometimes they need thrusters on it, you know, to adjust things, you know, when they have a camera on it or a transmitter or a laser, sometimes a laser beam that they might be testing. They need real fine movements. So this would be good. It sounds like a good company that might be able to do that. MagDrive and plasma. Do they talk about the engine, how the engine works? Is it an ion type of Brian back here?
Did you go to the website?
Did you ask me if I went to the website? No, I'm not going to be able to do that at this time.
Definitely have a chance to take a look at MagDrive, MagDrive. Very interesting. I think that's a lot of things in the works. Get away from chemical rockets. At least, you know, after you reach orbit.
Anyway, I'm just going to move on to a couple of the other topics that I wanted to cover.
Okay.
Read about it intently during the week, and I'm usually here every Sunday, so we'll be back next week with that topic. Firefly, another rocket company that's doing great. They build their own rockets, and they've launched 5 of them so far. And it's like medium lift vehicles, probably something maybe around the same category as the Spectrum one that I was talking about. Doing other things as well as building lunar landers. Now, the one that was very successful recently was the Blue Ghost lander that landed a couple of weeks ago on the moon, right at the beginning of the lunar day. Now, the lunar day takes up around 14 Earth days, then wind up 14 Earth nights. So it landed in early morning for the moon sunrise, and it went all the way to sunset. So it stayed operational 24 hours a day for days. And it turned out landed upright, first commercial vehicle from our company, our country that worked out really well. We had intuitive machines land a little over a year ago, and that was one of the ones that fell over, and they just had one that fell over again right before this one landed. We talked about that earlier with Leslie. But this one, Blue Ghost, very successful, had this drill, 10 different experiments, and they were all NASA experiments. And they had this drill that went down 3 feet. They wanted to send it down on 6 feet, but must have hit something hard down there. But it didn't matter. It turned out to do what they needed it to do. At the end, they had thermal couple that was able to tell the temperature, you know, that was at the inside the probe of this drill. So that worked out well. It landed precisely where they wanted to land. It was around 150 feet off from the exact location that they were going to land. But once the onboard computer picked a spot and said, "This is where I want to land," it landed within like 3 feet of that particular spot. So that worked out great. Then there were a couple of pictures that they, well, he sent pictures and video down. But I like the two pictures that they did send down when the sun was setting on the moon, on, you know, at the 14th day. They took a picture looking east, another one looking west, so during sunset, and they got some great pictures doing that, and it had scientific value. One of them, it looks like the moon is like on a greenish side, so that was a strange effect. The thing that I thought, you know, I saw the news conference, you know, at the end, this is after they were finished with the mission, and, you know, it went into lunar night, and it had this, I think a 10 amp hour battery. It was, the battery was able to run all these experiments into the darkness for a steady 5 hours. That was what they predicted, and that's what they got out of it, 5 hours of nighttime. Which is, you know, a big deal because, you know, in the daytime you have these 200 plus temperatures on the moon. So they knew, pretty much sure that all the electronics and everything would work on the moon with those temperatures. At night, when it goes all the way down, yeah, they could have heaters and things like that. But they need to supply power for these batteries. And of course, once it gets dark, the solar panels no longer function. But they did get 5 hours out of it. And they asked one of the head engineers during the news conference, what do you think about, you know, 14 days from now, you know, after the lunar night? They don't think it's going to make a comeback because it gets real cold up there. You know, you're looking at it like, you know, minus 300 degrees or more, and it's going to be very cold on the moon during the night. But they are going to try to listen to see if it does wake up once the solar panels start absorbing sun again, which would be, you know, great if they could do it. Now, this company has other launches planned. They have a mission planned at the end of the year, similar mission to this, like a Blue Ghost 2, and then a third mission sometime next year as well. And then if they get more contracts, NASA, or, you know, they'll be able to continue on. They have future plans for many landers. You know, don't forget, if they ever do get to land people on the moon is going to have to be resupplied. You know, from Earth, everything from food to material to science experiments to building equipment, and all these companies, these commercial landing companies, hope to get contracts to do just that. And if they could land accurately like this one did, you know, no problem. You know, so we'll see. We'll see how they do. Looking forward to the future lunar landing mission. They had plenty of experiments that seemed to all work good. They had cameras, four cameras on their legs. When they came down, they wanted to see how the regolith, or, you know, the dust on the moon, when the rocket, main rocket, was firing when they were landing. All this will help future landing missions. They had a vacuum cleaner on it. Why do they need a vacuum cleaner? Well, instead of a scoop reaching down and picking up material and then putting the material inside the vehicle to run tests on it, they thought, well, let's use a vacuum. And how do they have a vacuum to work in a vacuum? You know, you know, they thought that one out. And what they do is they have tanks on board, pressurized nitrogen shoots down, you know, into the scoop. To the exterior of the scoop, and that creates pressure. Nitrogen, of course, is inert, so it doesn't affect the samples, and the dust and little rocks blow up and wind up into the scoop. in this case, it actually gets sucked up into the vehicle. So that worked. You know, they got that, I'm sure they got that idea from the OSIRIS REx program. One that went out to that asteroid, Bennu, and did a, they call it a tag. They had this arm reach out, 7 foot arm, and at the end of it, this tag unit, the tag was TAG for touch and go. So this tag unit had a similar deal with, got close to the asteroid, and it blew nitrogen from the circumference of this arm, and it sucked rocks and everything into the arm, and then the arm was able to and put all the samples into a descent module, and eventually that made its trip back to Earth and separated from the mothership, you know, from OSIRIS-REx. Came flying through the atmosphere and the Utah proving ground out there, and was successfully picked up. And they were able to eventually open it up and do science experiments. But that system with the nitrogen and creating your own little vacuum, they said really worked well. Another one that worked good was they had this little plate, you know, looks like a 3 or 4 inch plate attached to the lander, and they had like little electrodes and things hooked up to it, so clear plate, and once dust and everything wound up on this plate, they ran power to it, and instantaneously the dust just like just disappeared, like an electrostatic reaction. So that will be helpful in the future. Regolith is very dangerous. You don't want to get it into your lungs. You don't like to get it into your joints of your spacesuit or the seal on a hatch. If you have a living quarters on the moon, you don't want that to get affected by regolith from the moon. So, you know, these types of experiments will help further down the road. So hopefully we keep this moon mission going. You know, every time you read something in the paper, you know, sometimes people think that they might cancel this. I hope they don't. It looks like right now, as far as NASA is concerned, they're going full blast. They still plan on launching later this year in September a crew of four to the moon, around the moon, and eventually come back to Earth. And that is called Artemis II. And that's still being planned. In fact, they have they just closed up the solar panels that are going to be needed for the mission. You know, they encapsulated those things. And, you know, these four solar panels that come out along, you know, they're like, I don't know, it looks like they're 50 feet long or 60 feet long. So they're all folded up, and they also put covers on them, around them, big covers. So it surrounds this whole vehicle, this whole Orion spacecraft. And after launch, once it gets into space, these covers pop off, and when they pop off, that exposes the solar panels, and they'll be able to open. So, that, you know, they were just doing that just the other day, I read. So they're going full steam ahead with Artemis II. Artemis III is the one that will eventually land on the moon. That's the plan right now. But, of course, we're going to have to wait a year or so for that, a year or so after Artemis II would come, Artemis III, so we've got quite a wait, probably late
2027 would be the earliest that might get. Any comments or questions?
This is Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform.
Hey Charlie, how are you?
I'm a lot better today than I was last week. Got a question. Now, Blue Ghost number 2 is not scheduled till the 26th, 2026, and Blue Ghost 3 is not scheduled till 2028. Are these going to be linked up?
Last time I read it was at the end of this year, and number 3 would be sometime next year. That could change. Apparently what you read is, the time frame is different. But Blue Ghost 2 has an interesting mission. It's actually going to land on the far side of the moon, which is pretty good. To do that, when they have that launch, it will be going up with another spacecraft, another satellite that will be in a high orbit around the moon, that Blue Ghost 2 will be able to use as a repeater. Once it's on the far side of the moon, any kind of transmission, RF, will not make it around the moon to back to Earth. So they need to have something stationed out there that could see the dark side of the moon, the far side of the moon, and can see the Earth at the same time. So it'll have to be a double launch when they do it. SpaceX still has the contract for that. But like I said, the ones that launch Blue Ghost is called Firefox. Firefly. Firefly. Now, Firefly is building their own launch vehicles, and they have one going up in a short period of time, this March. I don't have the exact date yet, but they plan on launching their 6th vehicle. They have a payload on it, nothing to do with the moon. They have a payload from Lockheed Martin that they're going to put up. They have many contracts. I think they have 25 satellites that they're going to be putting up, 25 separate launches for Lockheed alone. So it's a good-sized company. They're doing well. And, of course, they have these Blue Ghost landers. So we'll see, Charlie. I'm not sure about the landing dates. Last I heard was the next one was toward the end of the year. They talked about that at the news conference, which was about a week ago.
If Blue Ghost 2 goes to the dark side of the moon, how are you going to charge the solar panels? How are they going to charge the battery?
I know, dark side of the moon, yeah, that's a misnomer. It's not dark over there, We call it that. I still call it that once in a while. It's the far side of the moon. When I was growing up, it's the dark side of the moon. Oh, it's always dark there. But it's not. You think about it, think about the moon going around the Earth.
Complete.
And picture the sun in one particular location at one, and then you're looking at the moon, and it's opposite of it's sun, earth, moon, so it's opposite where you're looking when you normally look at the sun. Now the Earth is lit up, the moon is lit up, and as the moon moves around, and starts to come around by the sun. Naturally you don't see the far side of the moon. The moon doesn't turn as far as what, it turns once a month. It matches our, it matches the rotation of it, of itself going around the Earth. But it's the far side of the moon, eventually, you know, now you have Earth, Moon, Sun. So you're looking at the moon, and you know, it's like a new moon. It's getting dark, you know, but yet the sun is lighting up completely.